Monday, March 21st, 4th. To return to Israel briefly, Mr. Rutenberg, I've heard it said that the younger generation does not have the same dedication as their predecessors. Would you agree with that?
Not exactly, because the dedication is an entirely different nature. They're born to it. The Sabra is born in Israel. They have a different viewpoint. The ones we know primarily are secular, so that it's not a religious connection. But they're dedicated, and they serve in the army. You do get, for the first time, you had this Lebanese thing, which lacked consensus in the country, which you had a lot of problems with, but it hasn't substantially altered the basic commitment of the young people. Of course, there are exceptions. You hear about those, like everything else. You read about the accidents in the newspaper. You don't read about the safe trips that people make. And so you hear about the dissenters and so on. But in the main, we have Yochi Stern, who's 45. He's got two sons in the army, and there isn't any diminution of their dedication to Israel. They're more critical, and they're more vocal, and they're not to be compared with the pioneers. There were two sets of pioneers, the ones that came in the early days and cleared the swamps of malaria and built some huts around and created some farm villages, either like a kibbutz or a moshav. That's a different kind of thing. They left Europe with a motivation to create something new. Of course, that kind of dedication is not duplicated at all. It's unique to the generation. Many of them came, from wealthy families or well-to-do families. The real pioneers, many of them were, use an analogy, the Jewish artists of Mount Parnasse from 1900 to 1945, many of them, people generally think that they came from shtetls, like Chagall did, who was from a relatively poor family, but not an impoverished family. But Soutine came from a poor family, but Modigliani and many of the others came from quite well-to-do families. And likewise, take Meshel, who was the head of Histadrut for a number of years, just recently retired. He came from quite a very wealthy family in Poland. He was a young boy, a renegade. And Ben-Gurion didn't come from an impoverished family. So many of them came with only two nickels to rub to each other, without two nickels to rub together. But they were dedicated people. Now, it's unfair to compare to them to the attitude of the young people today. You have the conflict that I mentioned before between the pull of the great Renaissance in America, and in England too, but not as much as in America, not as sharply distinctive as in America.
You're talking about the Jewish Renaissance.
Yes, Jewish Renaissance, which is a great attraction, you know. So the Holocaust killed off the natural immigrants to form a state of Israel, and following it, we had the great Jewish Renaissance in this country, which instead of contributing immigrants to Israel, is a pull away, you know, because it's great to come here. This is a land of milk and honey if you want to work from 7 to 7, 7 days a week, as we all know. So there are many Israelis have come here, and I would say that that my estimate of how many Israelis with their descendants who have come to the United States, including what I call pass-throughs, Mike Shapiro, who's a professor of economics in the Graduate School of Business Administration at Pitt. We helped him when he came over as a student in 1956 and 7 and 58. Oh, he was born in Germany, and his parents came to Israel, but they sent him off to school with the idea of never coming back to Israel as an Israeli. And there are many pass-throughs like that. when you get up to a 500,000 population in America, in my opinion, 500,000. Mostly in the greater Los Angeles area and the greater New York area.
From east to west coast.
East to west coast. Well, on the coast, up to 6 million Jews, if we have that many in America, all but 1 million of them live along the sea. From the Penobscot to Key West, and from Seattle, Washington, down to La Jolla, San Diego. That's where all but 1 million of the Jews in America live. The rest of us live in Pittsburgh and Chicago and inland cities. And when you tab up the size of the communities and all those communities that are not on the water, you come up with not more than 1 million Jews.
That's interesting. I've never heard that before.
That's true. We're big city people. Mm-hmm. Big city people.
What about the kibbutz movement? Is it still strong in Israel?
Oh, sure, sure. The kibbutzim, our businesses are very wealthy. Remember, someone I was showing through a kibbutz said what lovely chicken houses they had for the chickens. And the kibbutznik who was with me, was showing us through, said, yeah, that's where we used to live, he says. And we didn't tear them down. We used them for chicken and turkey and so forth.
Have they modified their program at all in regard to family
practices? I would say the majority of them have. You take the kibbutz Gevim, where good friends of ours live, the sheriffs. They have, in the last 4 or 5 years, taken the children into the sleeping at home. Although there are a number of them that still have the younger children, even going up to high school age, who sleep in the children's quarters. So a lot to be said for both points of view, both practices. There's never been any evidence against the children's quarters. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of evidence that it's far better. They're shielded from the emotional strains that exist between a husband and wife, serious or not so serious, and the pressures. They're free of that, and they're also spending their time with their peers at their own age or children. I know in my own experience, sitting at the dining room table, there's a young granddaughter about 9 years old, and she says, all this talk, all this adult talk, stop it, it's boring. You see, we don't realize that. So she taught me that when their children at the table, I talk to them about things that are interest to them, and I see that we don't talk about things that are boring to them.
Was it Eric Erickson who did a study of the kibbutz?
No, it wasn't Eric Erickson. No, it was
Bettelheim.
Bettelheim. Very good. He did two excellent books. Yes.
Yeah, it seemed to me he.
Children of the Dream.
That's right, and he indicated, if I remember, that the children in the kibbutz, as adults, were so used to functioning in groups that they lacked initiative and creativity on their own. Had you read that?
Well, yes, I didn't. It didn't burn itself into my mind as that, but. We haven't had out of the kibbutzim or the moshavim, we haven't had creative new industries. They've all come from individuals primarily. And there are kibbutzim who do electronics work, but that's electronics that's farmed out to them. There's a lot of evidence to support that, I would say.
I remember being impressed with that.
But on the other hand, there are kibbutzniks that have left the kibbutz and become very creative as individuals. Because creativeness is something that's rare and unique, and it's just a small part of the population that are so blessed or burdened, depending on your viewpoint.
In your opinion, do you think Israel will ever be accepted by her Arab neighbors? Or will she have to forever be geared for war?
Well, there comes to be a prophet is to be a fool. And I'm no fool, I hope. All I can say is that there were many problems in the Middle Ages that never got solved. We have a black and white problem in this country that has not been solved. There are unsolvable, insolvable problems, and all you can do is develop practical accommodations with them from generation to generation, so that you had the accommodation of the lynching of blacks in this country, and you had the accommodation of from the civil rights movement in the 60s that's changed the relationship, but it's still an insolvable problem, and we just have created a form of accommodation to last for a generation or so. And it'll blow up in our face because you have now a schism between the few blacks who have made it, so to speak, as against a vast majority of blacks who are still impoverished and without hope. So, likewise with the Arabs. I mean, it takes an act of great optimism to believe that the Arabs will ever accept us, but on the other hand, there may be a combination of economic and social movements that that will dictate more practical, more collaborative accommodations. You never can overcome the Muslim. The Muslim theology, which says that if you're not a Muslim, you're an infidel. Death to the infidels. And jihad, holy war against the Jews, against the Christians. While the Muslims, when they occupied East Jerusalem and Mount Zion in part, they did as much, if not more, destruction to Christian cemeteries as they did to the Mount of Olives cemetery. So that Muhammad teaching is a roadblock I think you get practical accommodations like you have with Egypt now. But yet Egypt is subject to a revolution like Iran had, and like the Philippines have gone through, and like South Korea is threatened, and that will throw the Camp David agreement in the wastebasket, because it'll be a led by the people who killed Sadat, because it's just seething. It's a seething country, and any day why Egypt can blow up, any day.
Well, in the situation she's in, then Israel will always have to be geared for war. Is that correct?
They have to be able to prevent. They have to be strong enough to keep from being overrun. Like I said before in one of the other interviews, it took a great act of faith to believe a state could be created back in the 30s, before the Holocaust, before we knew the Holocaust was even coming, and it takes a great act of faith to believe that it can be sustained. But we go on the premise that it can be and it will be.
We have to. Earlier in the previous interviews, Mr. Rutenberg, you mentioned, when we talked about Franklin Roosevelt, you stated that under Roosevelt there would never have been an Israel.
That's right.
Would you comment?
Oh, absolutely. He was so, when he met with King Saud on the boat there on his way back from Yalta, he was an Arabist all the way through, and he would never have recognized the State of Israel like Truman did. We were very fortunate that Roosevelt had passed from the scene by the time of that historic event developed. And we know from Professor Wyman's book on the abandonment of the Jews that it came right from the top, from Roosevelt on down, that there was no interest in doing anything militarily or otherwise to really save the Jews from Hitler. It was kind of an acquiescence, really, when you look back upon it and look at all the evidence that Professor Wyman has produced from the archives. that it wasn't in the rescue committee, didn't get set up till 1944, and then only under great pressure, only under great pressure. And so Roosevelt was not emotionally and intellectually a friend of the Jews. He was a politician who accommodated himself. He used Jews as advisors, but so did many other anti-Semites do that. You know, he had no monopoly on that.
Shall we turn next to your involvement with art?
Yeah.
How did your interest in art first surface?
Well, my interest in art first served when my mother took me with black stockings and knee pants that they wore. She took me on a train from St. Paul, Minneapolis to Chicago to see the art collection of Mrs. Palmer, Palmer House, the hotel there. And her, that was before the Institute of Art in Chicago. And her collection, which adorned the Palmer House, and her apartment, their living quarters there, became one of the bases for the Chicago Institute of Art. And so I saw all those colors and those figures and pictures, and they always danced and made visions in my eyes. So I've always had an interest in art and in the plastic arts, and primarily paintings. Sculpture is secondary, although we have interest in sculpture now, but beginning it was just the paintings. They deal with your fantasies, they deal with your hopes, they deal with your sorrows, they deal with everything. Just like music does. And I learned music the same way because my mother was a great music lover and took me to concerts, and my brothers as well. But the art thing, music took with all my brothers, but they didn't take with the art. I was the only one. But I was the only one she took down in Chicago. It didn't take my older brother. My younger brother at that time, I think, was too young. I was very young then. I was much over 6 or 7 years old.
But it made a lasting impression, apparently. What can you tell us about your collection today? Is it principally art of Israel?
Yeah, well, my wife and I, we had 4 children because we saw the tragedy or the unhappiness or the loneliness of so many people with only 2 children. And so we said we were going to have 2 sets of children, 4-5 years between each set, and 2 years between them and each set. So as we prolong it, well, we prolonged it for another 5 or 10 years, or 5 or 7 years. They got through college, and we never ever sat down and said to each other, "Well, now we've got to find a mutual interest to keep us alive and revert to, and we both have equal interest in." We never had to sit down and say it. Just developed, you know, that the kitty came from Europe with a real European art background, and so we went to collecting art, which has made it possible for us to enrich our marriage, because this is our 50th wedding anniversary, but couples grow together or they grow apart, and there's nothing in between. There's nothing in between. Yes, there is in between. They grow apart, but they don't separate. So they have those who grow apart and separate, those who grow apart and those who grow together. And so it's been a joint enterprise of that kind. We began about 1960 with it. We would have begun earlier, but it wasn't until then when I had capital, because no matter how much your income is, and I have income, a 6-figure income of proportions, but income just never enough to buy art to amount to much. There's so many other things that you're calling on. You have to use capital. So we had capital beginning in 1960, and as it grew during the 60s, well, the art collection grew. We came along too late for the French artists. We enjoyed the New York School of Abstractionists, Gottlieb and Newman and Rothko. We enjoyed them to see them in a gallery or a museum, but we didn't enjoy them to hanging on the wall. There was only one that I was interested in, and that was Gottlieb. Kitty wasn't interested in him. So we let that go. New York school. Spain, we would have collected Spanish, modern Spanish art, except if there were no Israel. Because if there were no Israel, that would be the country of our, that would be our adopted country, because there's an empathy there among people, or with us anyway, in the Spanish people, particularly the Castilians in Madrid. But so there was Israel. Well, you in an art collection, you can't be like, what was it, Genghis Khan? Not Genghis Khan. Khan, who was this playboy? Khan is... What? Aga Khan, yeah, he married Rita Hayworth, yeah. One reporter says whenever one of their reunions, the next day he came out of the hotel all enthusiastic and he jumped in his sports car and went off in all directions. Well, you can't do that with an art collection and have a collection. So we decided to collect artists identified with Israel, and we've only had a couple of variations from that. Sam Rosenberg was a good friend and a great artist, who one day will be recognized for his greatness, I'm sure. And he never worked the commercial end of the art business, nor did his wife, and that's why it doesn't have that kind of recognition, but it will come. We have Rosenberg's, and Chaim Gross is a very good friend in New York. We have his works. I knew Ben Shahn quite well. We have a number of his pieces. And the Sawyer brothers, particularly Raphael Sawyer and Moses Sawyer, we have works of theirs. But other than that, it's been almost entirely artists identified with Israel. We do have some Chagall lithographs. They're the only lithographs that hang on our walls. Everything else is a watercolor or oil, primarily oils. We've got a whole cabinet full of graphics, but we don't hang them ourselves, either here or at Jerusalem Hall. But it's all oils and watercolors, etchings occasionally. Except my collection of women, I have some, those are etchings and graphics, I have a few graphics. In the bathroom, my women in the bathroom, there are 25 women in my bathroom.
I see.
All ages, all shapes, all forms.
I see.
So that's it, and there were very great collectors. Arnold Mermont was a great collector. He cautioned against buying on the basis of a particular country. He says, buy the artists. But then he looked, on the other hand, Eddie Hoken, who's quite a collector, his wife has a gallery in Palm Beach, Florida, in Chicago. He said, no, he says, you can concentrate on a country, he says, like France or Spain or Israel. I don't know whether there are enough good artists in Israel to concentrate on, but we found that there were. And so we went ahead on that basis, and now we're writing a book on collecting Israel art. And we've come up with two artists, both of whom were native-born in Israel, who are the two greatest artists that Israel's produced today.
Who are they?
The one that looks back to the Assyrian art is Moshe Castel. He'll be 80 years old in 1979. And the one who...
You're referring to these three paintings, right?
Yeah, the basalt work. So there's more than three. This is one of his early pieces here, the woman with a water jug on her head. Then you have Yaakov Agam. You have a menorah over there, maquette of a menorah on the curio case. That's an Agam there. He goes forward using the latest developments of science and mathematics. So you have one great artist.
He has a very distinctive style. Does he ever vary from that in painting?
Well, he stylizes. So Agam has a number of styles. He's done he begins to approach Michelangelo and how many different things he's done. Of course, he's the envy of everybody in Israel, and everybody loves to criticize somebody when they're out ahead, you know. And he's a kinetic artist primarily. But you see that maquette up there of 18, that menorah, that's a maquette of a menorah we gave to the president's house in Jerusalem. The piece up above, that's the first Agam piece we bought. That's a unique piece.
How's
changes as it goes. What?
How how's his name spelled?
A-G-A-M. Yaakov Agam. And we gave this large piece to the Carnegie Museum, where you walk around and change his design. Life's a passing shadow. We had that commission because I found in the quotation from the Talmud, in our prayer book during one of those boring hours of Yom Kippur, it says, life is a passing shadow, not of a tower, but of a bird. The bird passes and the shadow passes. So we gave that quotation to him, and he created the work that we did. We didn't have enough room in this apartment for it, so that's why we gave it to them.
I see. You have collected some sculpture also?
Yeah, sure, we have some sculpture, but we have a number of pieces of Chaim Gross, who's primarily a sculptor, although he's a great graphic artist and watercolorist also.
But basically it is Israeli art and sculpture.
Yes. With exceptions of the ones I mentioned, Chaim Gross, Raphael, Moses Sawyer, Ben Shawn, Chagall. We've got some Picasso plates that I fell in love with. Kitty wasn't for buying all of those, but now she's happy I did. We bought most of them at the Madura factory in southern France. The town's just a little bit above Antibes. Dad, I always forget the name of it, where Madura factory is. But there's a museum there in Antibes of all Picasso.
You and your wife have been generous and made significant donations locally, I believe. Carnegie and Temple Sinai also?
Oh, yeah. There are a number of pieces we've given Temple Sinai, and we gave a big castell to Temple Sinai, a large Rosenberg and the small Rosenberg, and the holidays, a set of lithographs by Chaim Gross on the Jewish holidays, are all framed and hung with the commentary on each holiday in our hall at Temple Sinai. And we gave about 75 pieces to the United Jewish Federation building, and we gave them pieces to the Fine Arts Department at Pitt, and about 25 of them hang in the School of Business, Graduate School of Business Administration at Pitt.
What about Israel?
We've given a number of works to Israel Museum, and also to the Hebrew Union College and Synagogue on King David Street in Jerusalem. And of course, we've given three large oils now to the Jewish Museum in New York.
Do you still continue to add to your collection?
Oh, sure. You know, it's like being an alcoholic. You can't stop. But we are restricted by where we can hang things. We don't have anything in storage, except we got about 50 pieces sitting on the floor around here. And I got about 60 pieces hanging in the office and about 40 of them on the floor.
Do you have a larger collection in your home in Israel than you have here?
Well, not much different in size. It's it's almost as big. It's unique in that it is 100% Israel, except the three menorah that we gave to Temple Sinai. One's outside, two's in the Bima. The maquette, we have a maquette of one of those in our Jerusalem home. Except for that, and I think another couple of Chagall, a couple of Gross sculptures. All the works there are by Israeli artists.
Have you ever been tempted to try your hand at it yourself?
No, I don't have a talent. I don't have a talent for transmitting to paper images. If I have any talent, it's not in that direction.
Anything else you would like to state about the art experience, what it's meant to you and your wife?
Well, it's a way of life, you know. Passionate art collectors like ourselves are shamelessly overhung, and we know all of our artists personally. And when we began, we bought from dealers galleries, but we don't buy much anymore from galleries. As far as Israel's concerned, we buy from the artists themselves. Because of the relationship, because of the selections that you can make, although they pretty much charge the gallery price. No, I don't haggle. We've never haggled or bargained for prices on art. It's not a commercial thing. It's the livelihood of the artist, and either if we think the price is too high, we just don't buy it. So I wouldn't say anything, we just don't buy it.
Now to return to your family, Mr. Rutenberg, your children, their careers, marriages, and so on. I think Charles is the oldest. Is
yeah,
that right?
Charles is the oldest.
And can you tell us something about his educational background and career?
Sure. Yeah, our two oldest boys went to MIT. And the oldest one, and they both graduated from there, one specialized